Okay, so I want you to picture the year 1896. It's a humid night. The air is just incredibly thick, and you are standing somewhere in this massive archipelago of over 7,000 islands.
Right, but the stark reality here is that there is no country called the Philippines yet. Not really.
Exactly. I mean, what you actually have is a Spanish colony, and it has been a Spanish colony for, 300 really long, suffocating years.
Yeah, generations upon generations have lived and died under the absolute authority of these colonial administrators and the watchful eyes of the Spanish friars.
Right, so even just the concept of an independent Filipino nation, it's not just a pipe dream. It is like actively treated as high treason.
Oh, absolutely. It's a highly policed society.
But underneath the surface, right, deep in the shadows of Manila, there's this secret brotherhood gathering, and they are preparing to gamble absolutely everything
Their lives, their families, everything.
to birth a nation out of thin air. And when they finally do step out of those shadows, they don't march under just one unified banner.
No, they don't. It's actually a lot messier than that.
Yeah, and this is why we're doing this. Because for communities who are deeply invested in this history, and I specifically want to shout out our friends in the Filipino American community, especially the Knights of Rizal, Orlando chapter, the modern Philippine flag is, a deeply revered object.
As it should be.
Right. But what most people, and even seasoned historians, honestly, tend to gloss over is the totally fragmented, surprising, and just chaotic journey of the 10 distinct revolutionary banners that had to fly first.
The banners that had to fly and bleed before that modern flag could even exist.
Exactly. So today we are taking a deep dive into the visual language of a revolution.
It's just such a vital story to uncover. Because think about it, when you are planning an uprising of that magnitude, something meant to shatter a three-century-old empire, you immediately face this massive logistical and, frankly, psychological problem.
Right, you need a way to communicate. You need symbols.
Exactly. You need a visual language to unite an entire archipelago of people who have been deliberately kept divided.
Because the Spanish strategy was just classic divide and conquer.
Oh, totally. They would constantly use local militias from one region to put down revolts in another region. So these revolutionary banners we're talking about, they weren't just
They
decorative.
were literal documents of defiance.
Yes. Woven from thread, dyed in desperation, and basically serving as the very first physical proof that a unified Filipino identity was even possible.
Okay, before we actually step onto the battlefield, there is this massive elephant in the room that we had to clear up right away.
Right, the acronym.
Yeah, let's unpack this immediately. Because if you're an American listener and you're looking at these 19th century revolutionary flags for the first time, you are going to see three very prominent white letters repeated in bold across several of them. KKK.
And we need to be crystal clear here.
Crystal clear. Because if you grew up in the US, your brain instantly associates that with the American white supremacist hate group. Let us set the record straight definitively right now. The KKK on these flags has absolutely zero connection to the American Ku Klux Klan. None.
None at all. It's a pure accident of language. The context, the geography, the ideology, completely unrelated.
Right. So what does it actually stand for in the context of Philippine history?
Well, the KKK stands for a deeply revered anti-colonial secret society that was founded in 1892, and its full name is this beautifully poetic Tagalog phrase.
Which we want to make sure we pronounce carefully, right?
Yes, it's Kataastaasang Kagalang-alangang Katipunan ng mga Atok ng Bayan.
Kataastaasang Kagalang-alangang Katipunan.
Exactly. And translated, that means the supreme and venerable society of the children of the nation.
Wow, the children of the nation.
Right, but in common conversation, it's just simply referred to as the Katipunan.
I mean, that name is so sweeping, it's romantic, and it instantly establishes this familial bond.
Yeah.
The children of the nation.
It really does. And it was founded by Andres Bonifacio.
Who was like a warehouse clerk.
Yeah, he was a self-educated warehouse clerk who just read extensively. He read about the French Revolution, the lives of American presidents, and he looked around at the Spanish oppression and just decided, you know what? Peaceful reform is no longer an option.
We have to fight.
Exactly. Which brings us to the very first visual element of the Katipunan's aesthetic, the color red.
Right, and it wasn't just like a bold design choice they picked from a color wheel to look cool in the wind. The deep crimson on these flags represented a very specific literal mechanism of the society.
Yeah, it represented the foundational act of the Katipunan, which was the blood oath.
Okay, the blood oath. Talk to me about that, because the paranoia of this era must have been suffocating.
Oh, it was absolute paranoia. The Spanish authorities had spies everywhere. Literally, a single whispered rumor of subversion could get your door kicked in at midnight. You'd face torture, execution.
So Bonifacio couldn't exactly just pass around a clipboard for people to sign up.
Right. No sign-in sheets. Members underwent this highly secretive, very solemn initiation ritual. It happened in hidden rooms, usually by candlelight.
It sounds terrifying, honestly.
It was meant to be serious. After they answered all these existential questions about the state of the motherland, the initiate had to do the sandugo, the blood compact.
The literal blood oath.
Yes. They would take a blade, make a small incision on their own left forearm, draw their own actual blood, and use it as ink to sign their name to the society's register.
I mean, I look at that process, and it's like the ultimate irrevocable non-disclosure agreement.
That's a great way to look at it.
But the stakes are inverted. You aren't just signing a contract. You are literally physically binding your life force to this secret. Like, if you break this NDA, you don't get sued. You go executed.
By the Spanish if you're caught, or by the Katipunan if you're a traitor.
Exactly.
And psychologically, it's just brilliant mechanics, because for 300 years, the colonial system ran on turning Filipinos against each other.
Right. Trust was practically non-existent.
Exactly. Trust was the most dangerous commodity. By forcing them to sign in their own blood, the Katipunan forces you to cross a psychological Rubicon. You're telling the guy next to you, my life is now indistinguishable from yours. If you fall, I fall.
Wow. Absolute terrifying commitment. You're either all in or you are the enemy.
There were no casual members of the Katipunan.
Which brings us to the very first flag. So try to visualize this. It's just a field of striking, unadulterated blood red. And right across the middle, three simple white Ks in a straight horizontal line.
Just KKK.
Yeah. And I'll be honest, when I first looked at this, my immediate thought was, well, that's not very imaginative.
Right. It's very basic.
But then when you actually dig into the reality of what late 19th century warfare looked like, you realize it's not about being artsy. It's about brutal functionality.
Oh, totally. We have to really strip away our modern ideas of warfare here.
Why?
These are not professional armies coordinating with headsets on clear battlefields.
No, these are mostly farmers, civilians.
Guerrilla fighters armed with bolos, mostly.
Which are basically heavy machetes for cutting sugarcane, right?
Exactly. And maybe, if they're lucky, a few captured Spanish Mauser rifles. They are fighting in dense tropical jungles, ravines, or dusty, narrow provincial streets. And the key thing here is the black powder.
Ah, right. The weapons.
Yes. Black powder produces enormous, thick, choking clouds of white smoke, unlike modern smokeless powder.
So after the very first volley of gunfire, you basically can't see anything. Visibility is zero.
It drops to zero almost instantly. So in that absolute chaos, the screaming, the smoke, the confusion, a really complex flag with an intricate little seal, it's completely useless. You literally can't read it.
But a bright red block of color with three massive high contrast white letters.
It cuts right through the fog of war. It's a beacon.
It tells that terrified farmer holding a sugarcane machete exactly where his brothers are making their stand.
It is a triumph of tactical simplicity. And that exact banner became the focal point of the revolution's explosive beginning in August 1896.
The cry of Pugadlawan.
Yes, Pugadlawan. Because the Katipunan secret had finally leaked. The Spanish friars found out. Arrests were happening all across Manila.
So Bonifacio and his followers had to run. They retreated to the hills of Balintawak, to Pugadlawan.
They were outgunned, they were outmanned, and their timeline was just completely forced. It was basically now or never.
And the specific act that kicks off the revolution there is just so visceral. Bonifacio stands in front of his people, and he tells them to take out their cedulas.
Right, the cedula personal.
Yeah. For our listeners, the cedula was the mandatory Spanish tax certificate. On paper, it was an ID card, but practically, it was a symbol of total subjugation.
You had to carry it at all times. It proved you paid your tribute to the Spanish crown.
And if you were caught without it?
You were presumed a vagrant, subject to arrest, forced labor, or worse. It was the physical paper chain tying you to the empire. And the cost of it was often crippling for average families.
So when Bonifacio tells them to tear up their cedulas, he's essentially telling them to publicly, physically declare themselves outlaws.
Yes. And they do it. They rip them to shreds, throw them on the ground and shout, you know, long live the Philippines, long live the Katipunan.
It's a mass declaration of independence achieved by literally destroying the bureaucratic paperwork of the oppressor.
It's incredibly powerful, and flying above that moment of pure explosive liberation is that red flag with the three white K's.
And just days later, that same flag catches its actual first bullets.
At the Battle of San Juan del Monte.
Right. They were vastly under-equipped, and they tried to capture a Spanish powder magazine. And they took heavy, heavy casualties. Dozens killed. The survivors had to retreat.
Tactically, it was a defeat.
But psychologically.
Yeah.
Massive victory. Because the flag wasn't just a secret society emblem hidden in a basement anymore. It was a participant in open war. It had tasted fire.
But this is where the reality of a massive insurgency dictates the visual history, right? As news of that battle spread, the revolution erupted across all these surrounding provinces like wildfire.
And when a grassroots movement grows that rapidly across such a fragmented geography, you just lose central control.
Completely. There is no centralized Katipunan supply chain pumping out identical flags. No factory in the jungle.
Communication is clandestine and painfully slow. So as new chapters form in different towns, they have to sew their own banners based on, what, vague verbal descriptions?
Exactly. Verbal descriptions or just the whims of the local leadership, which leads to this fascinating proliferation of variants.
Right. Like some chapters made flags with just one giant bold white K in the dead center.
And others kept the three Ks, but they reorganized the geometry. So instead of a straight horizontal line, they arranged them into an equilateral triangle. One K at the apex, two at the base.
Now, I initially assumed, looking at that, that it was just someone trying to be artistic. You know, just making it look cooler.
No, it wasn't just aesthetics. That geometry maps to something highly specific about how the Katipunan functioned.
Right. You pointed this out in the notes, and it blew my mind.
Yeah, the triangle variant was deeply purposeful. It was a direct nod to the internal clandestine structure of the society itself.
Because Bonifacio originally organized recruitment using a triangular cell system, right?
Precisely. To prevent the whole society from being compromised by one single spy, a central member would recruit exactly two new members. Those three formed a triangle.
But the key is, the two new recruits didn't know each other.
Right. And they didn't know anyone else in the broader organization. They only knew the person who recruited them.
So if one person is captured and tortured by the Spanish, which sadly happened a lot, they literally cannot betray the entire organization.
They can only give up the names of their specific immediate triangle.
That is wild. The flag itself is a literal diagram of their survival mechanism.
It's brilliant embedded code.
It really is. And honestly, it reframes how we look at these early variations, because modern people might look back and go, wow, these rebels were so disorganized they couldn't even get their flags to match.
But they weren't mistakes. Every slightly crooked stitch, every unevenly cut K, that's the handmade fingerprint of a local movement growing in the dark.
I love that phrase, the handmade fingerprint of a movement. But as these local chapters multiply, the center of gravity obviously needs a singular vision.
Yes, the leadership needed a standard.
The Supremo himself, Andres Bonifacio, he needed a personal war standard to rally the primary forces.
And his standard maintained that intense blood-red background, but he introduced a massive conceptual shift. Above the three white Ks, he placed a white sun climbing upwards, radiating light.
The introduction of the sun. This feels like a huge ideological leap.
It's profound. The three Ks represented the organization, the mechanics of the Katipunan, but the sun. The sun represents the ultimate destination.
Liberty.
Exactly. For a people subjugated for 300 years, the sun is the ultimate visual metaphor. It's the dawn finally breaking over a very long, very bloody colonial night.
It's saying we aren't just rebelling, we are awakening.
A new day is rising, literally.
And the creation of this specific standard holds one of the most honestly warm and intimate details of this entire deep dive.
It really does.
Because this flag wasn't commissioned from a tailor shop. It was sewn by the hands of Bonifacio's own wife.
Gregoria de Jesus.
Gregoria de Jesus.
She is a towering figure in Philippine history. She was formerly known as the Lakambini of the Katipunan.
Which usually gets translated as the muse of the revolution.
Right, it does. But I think muse is such a limiting word. It implies passivity, like she's just sitting there looking inspiring.
Right, while the men do the actual work.
Exactly. And that couldn't be further from the truth. She was fiercely active. She worked alongside another remarkable woman, Benita Rodriguez, to meticulously sew this standard.
And I really want to push back on how we usually consume this kind of historical trivia. Like, we hear she sewed the flag, and we picture this quiet, domestic, almost quaint scene, two women chatting over needle and thread.
Right, very peaceful.
But we have to remember the context. Doing this was an act of high treason.
Absolutely. The Spanish Guardia Civil were actively conducting raids, kicking down doors in Manila neighborhoods looking for anything subversive. To possess revolutionary material was a death sentence.
So Gregoria wasn't just a seamstress. She was the custodian of the Katipunan's most dangerous secrets.
When the Spanish forces would raid their neighborhood, Bonifacio would be out organizing, and Gregoria would be the one frantically gathering up all the highly incriminating membership documents, the blood oaths, the official seal.
Oh my God.
She'd hide them on her person, or she'd literally hire a carriage and drive aimlessly around the city for hours until the raid was over, knowing that if she was stopped and searched,
she'd be executed?
Exactly. She guarded the literal existence of the revolution with her own life.
It just adds such a profound layer of humanity to these artifacts of war. The very hands that were smuggling documents under the noses of the Spanish were the same hands that lovingly crafted the banner leading the men into the gunfire.
There's an incredible intimacy to that history. The physical fabric of the revolution was stitched by women who fully understood the absolute peril of what they were creating.
But as with all massive historical movements, that initial unity is incredibly difficult to sustain. Revolutions are human endeavors, and humans fracture.
They always do. And as the uprising gained serious ground, particularly in the province of Cavite, which is just south of Manila, the sheer scale of the war began to outgrow Bonifacio's original leadership structure.
Cavite is where the story gets really complicated, and honestly a bit tragic. It's where the geographic and class divides really start to show. Because in Cavite, the Katipunan essentially split into two distinct and increasingly rival provincial councils.
Right. They're fighting the same Spanish enemy, but operating almost independently. And naturally, each council had its own distinct flag.
Of course. So let's look at the first of these two powerful factions, the Magduan Council.
The Magduan were led by Mariano Alvarez. And interestingly, Alvarez was actually the uncle of Gregoria de Jesus.
Bonifacio's wife.
Exactly. So because of these deep family ties, the Magduan Council was generally fiercely loyal to Bonifacio as the Supremo.
And their flag, the Magduan flag, is this bold departure from the text-heavy banners we've seen so far. It keeps that visceral red background. But the three Ks are completely gone.
Entirely gone.
Instead, there's this massive, blazing white sun dominated the entire center of the flag. Mm. I mean, it doesn't leave much room for anything else.
It's an unapologetic declaration.
Yeah, it really is. And then, operating the same province, you have the rival council, the Magdalo.
Right. Now, the Magdalo were rallying around a rising, incredibly charismatic star in the revolution, a young local mayor and military commander named Emilio Aguinaldo.
Aguinaldo.
Yes. And unlike Bonifacio, who was actually struggling pretty badly in his military campaigns around Manila, Aguinaldo was a tactical genius on the battlefield.
He was actually winning.
He was winning decisive pitched battles against entrenched Spanish forces in Cavite, and every victory brought the Magdalo massive prestige, weapons, recruits.
Shifting the balance of power away from Bonifacio.
Exactly.
Which brings us to the Magdalo flag. So like the Magduang, it uses a sun on a blood-red field. But right at the center of that sun, inside the actual orb, sits something truly incredible.
It really is.
It's a symbol that would look completely unfamiliar to a modern Spanish soldier, and honestly, probably to some modern Filipinos today. It's an ancient letter, the letter Ka, written in a script called Baybayin.
Yes, Baybayin.
So for listeners who might not know, what exactly is Baybayin? I mean, how do you even spell that?
It's B-A-Y-B-A-Y-I-N. Baybayin.
Mm-hmm.
And it is the indigenous pre-colonial writing system that Filipinos utilized for centuries before the Spanish galleons ever arrived in the 1500s.
Oh, wow. So it's an old, old script.
Very old. It's an elegant, flowing script. But the thing is, by the 1890s, after 300 years of forced Spanish colonial education, the imposition of the Latin alphabet.
And the friars just deliberately erasing indigenous culture.
Exactly. By that point, Baybayin was largely considered a dead script in everyday urban life. You might find it in some dusty archive or deep in the mountains, but it wasn't how people were writing letters to each other.
So this is where I have to pause.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have to ask the obvious question here.
Go for it.
If you are Emilio Aguinaldo,
mm-hmm.
and you're trying to establish a modern late 19th century republic, like you're buying modern rifles, you're trying to get international recognition from places like the US and Japan, why on earth do you look backwards?
Right. Why resurrect a 300-year-old dead script and slap it right in the middle of your war flag?
Yeah, why do that?
What's fascinating here is that it is a masterclass in anti-colonial messaging. We have to remember that colonialism doesn't just extract resources and steal land. Its most insidious weapon is stealing history.
Oh, wow. Stealing history.
Yes. The grand Spanish colonial narrative, the one pushed by the friars for three centuries, was basically, before we arrived, you were disorganized savages living in the dark. We brought you civilization, infrastructure, and the light of God.
Which is a narrative entirely designed to make the colonized feel inferior and dependent.
Exactly. Because if you truly believe you were nothing before the empire, you are way less likely to fight it.
That makes total sense.
So by digging up that ancient Bebeinka, which stood for Katipunan, or perhaps Kalayan, meaning freedom, and placing it at the dead center of the rising sun, the revolutionaries are completely shattering that colonial narrative.
It's like a profound intellectual rejection of the entire Spanish premise.
They are reaching back across three centuries of erasure, completely bypassing Spanish rule, to boldly declare, we were someone before you came.
We had our own writing. Our own complex societies.
Trade networks, a distinct identity. We are not just a byproduct of your conquest.
That is just. It's such an assertion of deep indigenous sovereignty. They're saying true freedom isn't just kicking out the Spanish. It's reclaiming a stolen cultural identity.
They're fighting for the future by anchoring themselves in their authentic past. It is an incredibly sophisticated statement for a guerrilla army to make on a piece of cloth.
It really is.
Yeah.
Okay, I want to ask our listeners to actually put a mental pin in those two flags right now. The Magdalene's blazing sun and the Magdalo's sun with the ancient Bebeinka.
Yes, remember those.
Memorize them because we are going to revisit them at the end of this deep dive. And there's a massive historical twist waiting for us regarding those specific flags.
But while the politicians and regional commanders were fracturing and, you know, debating grand ideology in Cavite, the war itself was raging fiercely across other provinces.
Me.
And out on the actual battlefields, the aesthetics of the revolution were adapting to the escalating violence, taking on entirely new and sometimes truly terrifying forms.
Terrifying is absolutely the right word. Because if you were a Spanish conscript fresh off the boat from Madrid, the red flags of the Katipunan were definitely scary enough.
Oh, sure.
But imagine marching through the dense, sweltering provinces north of Manila. You look across a clearing, and you see a completely different banner. We're leaving the red behind entirely here.
Completely different vibe.
This flag is pitch black. And emblazoned in stark white in the center is a single K. Right next to a grinning, macabro skull and crossbones.
Yeah, this was the personal standard of General Mariano Llanera. He operated primarily in the central plains north of Manila. Places like Nueva Ecija, Bulacan, Pampanga, Tarlac.
And his background is really interesting, right?
Very. He wasn't a grassroots peasant rebel. He was actually a former gobernadorcillo, a municipal captain who had worked within the Spanish system before defecting to the revolution.
So he knew how they operated.
Exactly. Because he understood the Spanish military apparatus from the inside, he brought this deeply pragmatic and incredibly ruthless edge to his military campaigns.
Now, I have to be completely honest here. When I first saw a picture of Llanera's flag, my immediate thought was, is this just pirate energy?
It looks exactly like a pirate flag.
Right. It looks like he just hoisted the Jolly Roger in the middle of a land revolution in the Philippines. And apparently, even the Supremo, Bonifacio, who is known to be this incredibly serious, austere guy, he supposedly found this flag hilarious.
He did. He playfully mocked General Llanera about it and nicknamed the banner Bungo ni Llanera, which literally translates to Llanera's skull.
Bungo ni Llanera. But jokes aside, a skull and crossbones on a pitch black field is pure psychological warfare.
It absolutely is. And we have to view it in the context of what was actually happening in those northern provinces at the time.
Huh?
By the time Llanera is flying this skull banner, the Spanish have abandoned any pretense of putting down a riot.
Right, it's not a policing action anymore.
They are waging a war of absolute terror. They are utilizing the garrote to execute suspected rebels in public squares.
Oh, God.
They are dragging people to Bagumbayan, which is where Dr. Jose Rizal would famously be executed, and having firing squads shoot them in the back. Thousands are being thrown into the dungeons of Fort Santiago to rot.
So the idealistic dawn of Bonifacio's rising sun, that hopeful imagery, it didn't quite match the sheer carnage Llanera's men were facing on a daily basis.
Exactly. The red flag spoke of blood oaths and the hopeful dawn of liberty. Yanira's black flag strips all that romantic idealism away.
It communicates a singular, chilling message directly to the Spanish commanders.
You cannot intimidate us with execution because these men have already made peace with dying.
It's essentially declaring we are already ghosts.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, think about it. If I'm a Spanish soldier and my entire authority rests on the threat of lethal violence, how do I fight an enemy who has embraced their own mortality as a weapon? You are fighting men who do not intend to survive.
It must have been incredibly demoralizing for the occupying forces. It reflects a revolution that has moved past the romance of a secret society and into a desperate, grinding, bloody fight for survival.
Yanira's flag is the visual embodiment of that stark reality. But then from the pure terror of the skull banner, we transition to a flag that feels, I don't know, more calculated, almost like an architectural blueprint for the future.
Yes, a very structured flag.
This banner belonged to General Pio del Pilar, who was the commander of what is now the modern towering financial district of Makati.
Mm-hmm.
And Pio del Pilar's flag is where the puzzle pieces really start to snap into place for anyone who knows what the modern Philippine flag looks like.
Right. When you analyze General Pio del Pilar's design, you immediately see the structural bones of the modern era. He retains the red field, honoring the Katipunan blood oath.
Okay, still red.
But at the hoist, which is the side of the flag attached to the actual flagpole, he introduces a massive white equilateral triangle.
Okay.
Inside that white triangle is a sun with rays, and at each of the three corners of the triangle, he places a K.
This is the moment I want our listeners to really visualize. We've had the red fields, we've had the various suns, we've had the Ks scattered around.
Mm-hmm.
But Pio del Pilar is the one who brings in the white triangle on the side.
Yes.
If you close your eyes and picture the flag that every Filipino salutes today in schools across the country, that white triangle at the hoist and the rayed sun inside it are the exact foundational anchors of the design.
They absolutely are. This flag represents a crucial synthesis of ideas. The triangle, as we explored earlier, honors the foundational clandestine cell structure of the original Katipunan.
Right, the survival mechanism.
But the sun inside that triangle is evolving in its meaning. In Pio del Pilar's flag, and in the iterations that immediately followed, the sun doesn't just have random beams of light. It features exactly eight distinct rays.
And those eight rays are not just a stylistic choice made by a bored tailor.
No, not at all.
They are highly specific, encoded data.
They are deeply historical. The eight rays immortalize the first eight provinces that the Spanish Governor General Ramon Blanco placed under a strict state of martial law immediately after the revolution broke out.
And those provinces were?
Manila, Cavite, Bulacan, Pampanga, Nueva Ecija, Bataan, Laguna, and Batangas.
These were the areas that dared to rise up first, and consequently they took the absolute brunt of the empire's wrath. Entire villages were burned to the ground.
By embedding those eight rays directly into the geometry of the flag, the revolutionaries are creating a permanent memorial.
It's a way of ensuring that future generations will never forget who formed the vanguard of the revolution, who bled first to make freedom a possibility.
It is historical record keeping, achieved entirely through vexillology.
No. As the revolution wears on, and they're taking immense casualties, the leadership faces a new hurdle. They realize that if they want international support, they can't just be viewed as a chaotic insurgency hiding in the jungles.
Right. They need legitimacy.
They need to project the image of a legitimate, functioning government.
And this necessity leads to a fascinating and visually somewhat surreal chapter in the history of the revolution.
Oh, I know where we're going with this.
In late 1897, after a series of brutal Spanish offensives, Emilio Aguinaldo and his forces are pushed out of Cavite. They retreat deep into the rugged, mountainous terrain of Bulacan to a heavily fortified area called Biaknabato.
Biaknabato.
Yes. And surrounded by caves and natural defenses, they formally declare the Republic of Biaknabato. It comes with a constitution, a structured government, and, naturally, a highly distinct flag.
This is the flag that always catches people totally off guard.
It's definitely unique.
It's the sun with a face.
Mm.
And when we say face, we do not mean an abstract suggestion. We mean a literal, distinct human face illustrated inside the sun. A white sun on a red field, complete with two eyes, a nose, and a mouth, gazing neutrally right back at you. It radiates eight clusters of rays.
It's very striking.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here. We just talked about Linera's terrifying skull and Pio del Pilar's sleek modern geometry. When I look at a smiling sun face, it feels almost whimsical.
It does to modernize, yeah.
It looks like bad 19th century clip art or something from a children's book.
If I'm a hardened guerrilla fighter, does this actually inspire me? Like, why a face?
What's fascinating here is that it definitely strikes our modern sensibilities as quaint or even jarring, but we have to analyze it through the lens of 19th century global iconography.
Okay, tell me more. In classical European heraldry, which heavily influenced Spanish colonial art, and subsequently, the revolutionaries who were educated in that system anthropomorphizing celestial bodies was a standard way of conveying power.
You actually see it in the flags of Argentina and Uruguay today, right?
Exactly. Giving the sun a face is a specific symbolic mechanism. It turns an abstract, inanimate concept, a ball of gas in the sky, into an active, living entity.
Okay, let's unpack this. It's shifting the sun from a background element to a character.
Precisely. The face transforms the rising sun into the personification of the nation itself. It implies a conscious entity. The Republic is no longer just an idea, it is awake.
It is watching.
Yes. It has eyes to witness the suffering of its people, and it has a mouth to boldly declare its independence to the world. It marks a psychological evolution from a flag representing a secret society, the Katipunan, to a flag representing a living, breathing Philippine Republic.
The nation is awake and watching.
Ew.
When you frame it like that, it completely loses the clip art vibe and takes on a completely different gravity.
It becomes incredibly profound.
But the Republic of Biacnabato doesn't last. The stalemate in the mountains leads to a controversial pact, a temporary truce with the Spanish, where Aguinaldo accepts exile in Hong Kong in exchange for financial compensation and promised reforms.
But the fire isn't entirely put out. The truce breaks down, the fighting slowly resumes, and a new generation of incredibly young heroes steps into the vacuum.
Which brings us to one of the most romanticized and ultimately tragic figures of the entire era, General Gregorio del Pilar.
He was famously known as the Boy General.
Because of his extreme youth, his handsome features, and his incredibly daring military exploits. And Gregorio del Pilar carried a standard that introduced a massive aesthetic leap, the first Filipino tricolor flag.
Yes, a three-color design.
Up until now, we've been bathed in fields of red and white, with Yanira's brief foray into black. But Gregorio brings in this sophisticated tricolor. The top band is red, continuing to honor the immense blood sacrifice of the Katipunan.
And the bottom band is black, directly inspired by General Yanira's skull banner, representing that fierce, death-defying commitment.
And at the hoist, replacing Pio del Pilar's white triangle is a blue triangle.
And the mechanism behind that blue triangle is just phenomenal. It links the Philippine struggle to a massive geopolitical reality.
This is one of my favorite facts from this whole deep dive.
That specific blue triangle was directly patterned after the flag of revolutionary Cuba.
Wait, how is that even possible? Cuba is on the other side of the planet. How are guerrilla fighters in the Philippine jungles taking design cues from the Caribbean in the 1890s?
It speaks to the globalized nature of late 19th century anti-colonialism. While the Filipinos were fighting the Spanish in the Pacific, the Cubans were fighting the exact same Spanish empire in the Atlantic.
Wow, both were centuries-old colonies striving to break free simultaneously.
Exactly. And because of newly laid international telegraph cables and underground networks smuggling newspapers from places like Hong Kong and Madrid, the Philippine revolutionaries were actually highly informed about the Cuban struggle.
That is just astounding.
By explicitly adopting the Cuban triangle, Gregorio del Pilar's flag is making a massive international statement. It represents Filipino freedom acting in conscious solidarity with the broader world's anti-colonial movements.
Before social media, before global news networks, these young rebels are signaling across the oceans to other colonies saying, "We see your fight, we are fighting the same monster, and we are with you."
It's beautiful solidarity.
But the story of Gregorio del Pilar and his beautiful tricolor doesn't end with a parade. It ends in absolute tragedy. Let's fast forward slightly. The Spanish are eventually defeated, primarily because the United States enters the picture.
Right, the Spanish-American War.
But the Americans don't leave. They decide to keep the Philippines as their own colony. Suddenly, the exhausted Filipino army is fighting a new, vastly more powerful, heavily industrialized colonizer.
United States.
In the Philippine-American War, it is a devastating turn of events. The conventional Philippine army is quickly crushed by American firepower, forcing your return to guerrilla tactics. President Aguinaldo is on the run, retreating deep into the treacherous, freezing mountainous regions of the north, desperately trying to escape the advancing American cavalry.
And in December 1899, at a narrow, freezing mountain pass called Tyrid Pass, Gregorio del Pilar is given a monumental task.
He is ordered to lead the rearguard action. His job is to block the pass against the Americans to buy enough time for Aguinaldo to disappear into the mountains.
It is the Filipino Thermopylae. The geography of Tirad Pass made it highly defensible, but the odds were insurmountable. Gregorio del Pilar is commanding a skeletal force of just 60 men.
60 men.
They are starved, exhausted, and low on ammunition. Advancing on them are over 300 heavily armed, well-supplied American soldiers from the 33rd Volunteer Infantry Regiment.
From a tactical standpoint, it is a suicide mission.
And the boy general knows it completely. The night before the battle, he sits down in the freezing mountains and writes a final entry in his diary. I am surrounded by fearful odds that will overcome me and my gallant men, but I am pleased with the thought that I die fighting for my beloved country.
The sacrifice is just unfathomable. The next day, the battle commences. Del Pilar's men hold off the initial American assaults, using the high ground to their advantage. But eventually, the American forces, aided by a local guide who showed them a secret path to the top of the ridge, managed to outflank the Filipinos.
They rain down fire from above. Gregorio del Pilar is riding his horse, trying to rally his crumbling lines, when he is shot through the neck by an American sniper. He dies instantly.
And the American forces loot his body for souvenirs, stripping him of his uniform, his boots, his diary. He was left unburied for days until an American officer, moved by his bravery, eventually gave him a proper burial with military honors.
And we have to remember his age.
He was 24 years old. Let that sink in for a moment. Think about what you were doing at 24. Most of us are just trying to figure out our entry-level careers, maybe worrying about rent, figuring out what to do on the weekend.
At 24, Gregorio del Pilar was commanding an army, carrying a flag of global solidarity, and leading a rearguard action to the death, fully knowing he would not survive, all to protect a republic that barely even existed yet.
It is a profoundly sobering reminder of the literal human cost woven into the fabric of these flags. They aren't just colorful designs we print on posters. They were the burial shrouds of an entire generation that willingly gave up their youth and their futures so that a nation could eventually be born.
Absolutely.
So out of all these splintered factions, the different provincial councils, the shifting ideologies, and the immense loss of life, a final flag emerges. We arrive at the banner that finally attempts to unify the entire fragmented narrative. The flag of the Philippines.
And the story of its creation actually takes us completely off the battlefields and out of the country entirely.
Right, back to 1898, during that brief exile in Hong Kong following the Pact of Biak-Numbato. Emilio Aguinaldo realizes that if he is to return to the Philippines, resume the revolution, and formally declare absolute independence, he needs a new symbol.
He can't fly a Katipunan flag or a Magdalo flag. He needs a single, unifying national flag that represents a sovereign, modern nation-state.
So he sketches out a detailed design and takes it to a highly skilled woman living in exile named Marcela Aganchilo.
And once again, the narrative rightly returns to the hands of women. Marcela Aganchilo wasn't just a seamstress. She was a highly educated, affluent woman, deeply committed to the cause.
She enlists the help of her young daughter, Lorenza, and another remarkable woman, Delfina Herbosa de Natividad.
And Delfina brings an incredible pedigree to this room. She is a direct niece of Dr. Jose Rizal, the great martyr whose writings sparked the intellectual foundation of the revolution.
These three women spend 5 painstaking days in a house in Hong Kong, hand-sewing this immense, incredibly intricate flag from fine silk.
And the design Aguinaldo tasked them with is a masterful piece of historical synthesis. It gathers up the entire messy, fragmented history of the previous years and weaves it into one cohesive cloth.
Let's break down the mechanics of this final design for the listener, piece by piece. First, dominating the hoist, you have the white equilateral triangle.
This is the enduring legacy of the Katipunan, honoring that original secret cell structure and echoing the geometry first laid out by Pio del Pilar.
Inside that white triangle, you have the golden sun. But it's no longer the blazing sun of Magdiwang or the face of Biak-Numbato. It is a formalized sun with exactly 8 rays.
Once again, immortalizing the first 8 provinces that rose up in arms and faced the martial law decrees. It grounds the nation in the geography of its first sacrifices.
Then, at the 3 corners of the triangle, the Ks, which had dominated almost every flag prior, are finally gone. The era of the secret society is over. In their place are 3 5-pointed golden stars.
Those 3 stars represent a massive leap in national consciousness. They represent the 3 major island groups of the Philippine archipelago: Luzon in the north, the Visayas in the center, and Mindanao in the south.
This is crucial because it formally declares that this is no longer just a localized rebellion around Manila. It is a unified national movement encompassing the entire archipelago from tip to tip.
Then you have the colors of the main field, a top band of deep blue representing the high ideals of peace, truth, and justice, and a bottom band of red carrying forward the visceral legacy of the Katipunan, representing the patriotism, the blood oaths, and the immense courage and blood spilled by men like Yanera, Bonifacio, and the Boy General.
And there is one final, incredibly unique and chilling mechanism built into the very design of this flag. It is one of the only national flags in the world that indicates a state of war strictly by how it is physically flown.
Yes. In times of peace, the blue band is flown on top. But when the country is actively at war, the flag is inverted. It flies red side up.
Red side up only when the country is at war. It's a built-in alarm system for the entire country. It's the nation physically tensing its muscles. When that flag was first unfurled from the window of Aguinaldo's home during the Declaration of Philippine Independence in Cavite, Cavite, on June 12, 1898, it must have been a moment of unbelievable, overwhelming catharsis.
To see all those disparate, warring factions finally stitched into one cohesive, beautiful identity, it was the culmination of a deeply painful, bloody, and glorious journey. The visual language had finally coalesced into a single voice.
Okay. We've walked through the journey, we've seen the blood oaths, the skulls, the ancient scripts, and the Cuban triangles. But here is where we pull the rug out. This is the historiographical twist I promised you at the very beginning of the deep dive.
Yes, and this twist fundamentally changes how we view the entire nature of how history is recorded and remembered.
If you grew up in the Philippines, or if you've ever bought historical posters, flashcards, or textbooks about this topic, you have likely seen this exact sequence of flags we just talked about. And they are almost always sold and taught under a very specific, confident title, The Evolution of the Philippine Flag.
Right, and the word evolution is doing an incredible amount of heavy lifting in that title. It implies a neat, linear, almost biological progression.
It suggests that Flag 1 naturally and smoothly morphed into Flag 2, which then logically begat Flag 3 and so on, climbing an orderly sequential ladder until we reached the perfect, finalized modern flag at the top.
Exactly like those famous evolutionary charts showing the ape slowly standing up step by step until it becomes a modern human.
We crave that kind of clean, sensible narrative. We want history to look like a well-managed project timeline. But when rigorous historians, specifically brilliant minds like Ambeth Ocampo and Xia Chua, actually dig past the posters and into the primary archives, they burst this neat little bubble completely.
They absolutely do. What their research reveals is that this evolution narrative is a highly misleading post-war myth.
Wait, really? A myth?
Yes. These banners were not successive versions of a single national flag being updated over time, like software patches. As we've discussed today, these were the separate, highly personalized, and fiercely independent flags of different generals, different factions, and different provincial councils.
And the kicker is that many of them were flying at the exact same time.
Exactly. It wasn't a relay race where one flag was handed off to the next. General Yanera was flying his terrifying black skull banner in the swamps of Nueva Ecija at the exact same time that Aguinaldo was flying his sun flag in the fields of Cavite.
It wasn't a tidy family tree. It was a chaotic, simultaneous explosion of competing symbols. Furthermore, this neat set of 10 completely ignores the dozens, maybe hundreds, of other hyper-local battalion flags that actually flew in skirmishes across the thousands of islands.
And Xiao Chua's work goes even further. And this is where it gets truly controversial for people who grew up memorizing these posters. He notes that for three of these famous flags, there is very little hard, physical, contemporary documentary evidence that they looked exactly the way they're depicted in these standardized sets.
Wait, which three?
The three in question are the supposed Magdiwang flag with the massive blazing sun, the supposed Magdalo flag with the Baybay and Ka in the center, and even the Biakna Bato sun with the smiling face.
The flags I literally told our listeners to put a pin in, the ones with the deepest anti-colonial symbolism. Are historians saying they are entirely fake?
It's not that they're complete fabrications invented out of thin air, but their exact standardized designs as seen in the evolution sets are historically murky. They might be composites based on vague oral accounts recorded decades later, or artistic liberties taken during the 1920s and 30s to create a visually balanced set for educational purposes.
Oh, wow. So they were kind of standardized retroactively to look good on a poster.
Exactly. We know Magdalo and Magdiwang had flags, but the exact dimensions and details we take for granted might be historical reconstructions rather than primary realities. Because of this, the National Historical Commission of the Philippines actually prefers a much more honest, if less poetic, title. They don't call it the Evolution of the Philippine Flag. They simply call them Flags of the Philippine Revolution.
So, we are presented with this beautifully packaged, neat set of flags that shows a perfect, unified march toward destiny. And the historical truth is that it's deeply messy. It's decentralized. Rivals were flying different flags at the same time. Some massive contributions are completely missing from the mainstream narrative. And a few of the most famous designs might be historical composites.
That's the reality of it.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. Does this ruin the history? When we pull back the curtain and see the chaos, does it diminish the romance and the heroism of the revolution?
I would argue the exact opposite. I think it makes the history vastly more compelling and far more impressive. The evolution myth makes the Philippine Revolution look like a sterile, perfectly planned corporate rollout managed by a unified board of directors. But real revolutions, the ones that actually change the world, are never clean. They are messy, they are highly decentralized, they are fraught with bitter internal disagreements, and they are driven by raw, unvarnished human passion.
Yes. The fact that different commanders in different provinces had to literally invent their own symbols on the fly, using whatever cloth, whatever indigenous scripts, or whatever pirate imagery they had, doesn't make the hero smaller. Makes them so much more real.
It proves that this wasn't an edict handed down from wealthy elites in a boardroom. It was a desperate, scrambling, improvisational fight for survival by ordinary people thrust into completely extraordinary circumstances.
Exactly. When you strip away the sanitized textbook myth, you are left with the profound, complicated humanity of the struggle. You see the internal debates, the wildly diverse visions for what the new nation should look like, and the chaotic, terrifying reality of fighting a massive empire with farming tools.
And paradoxically, seeing all that division makes the eventual unification under the final flag in 1898 that much more miraculous. They didn't agree on everything. They marched under wildly different banners, but they ultimately bled into the exact same earth for the exact same dream.
And that messy, complicated, deeply human reality is exactly why communities like the Knights of Rizal Orlando chapter keep telling these specific stories. We don't gather to tell these stories just to memorize a perfect, unassailable timeline of events.
Right.
We tell them to connect with the very real, very flawed, and unfathomably brave human beings who dared to imagine a future that we now get to live in.
Dr. Jose Rizal, the man whose intellect and ultimate martyrdom sparked so much of this awakening, understood the raw power of these symbols intimately. In his writings, he once noted, "While a people preserves its language, it preserves the marks of its liberty."
That's a beautiful quote.
We usually think of language merely as spoken words or dialects, but these flags, these visual symbols, the blood-red fields, the white suns pushing back the dark, the defiant skulls, the ancient Baybayin script, they are a language.
They are the visual vocabulary of freedom. 10 banners, 10 heroes, countless unnamed sacrifices. It is the story of one nation that almost wasn't. And it reminds us of the solemn motto of the Knights of Rizal, "Non omnis moriar," I shall not wholly die.
Through the act of remembering, through the telling of these chaotic, beautiful, and sometimes terrifying stories, the heroes actually live on. The physical cloth may fade in museums, the threads may break down over a century, but the ideas they represented are permanently woven into the identity of the people.
I shall not wholly die. That concept carries so much weight. And it leaves us with something really profound to chew on as we wrap up this deep dive. We've spent this time looking backward over 100 years. We've seen how these people, living under suffocating colonial darkness, literally stitched their identity, their rage, their ancient history, and their defiance into physical pieces of cloth. They had to hand make the very banners they marched under to prove they existed.
It makes you wonder. In an age where we no longer march into literal battles under handmade physical banners, in a world dominated by digital avatars, fleeting online statements, and easily digestible posts, what are the invisible flags we fly today? In our communities, in our families, how are we signaling who we are, what we value, and where we came from?